This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. A few dozen friends of mine gave me a wonderful Christmas present. They each recorded some Christmas stories for me to broadcast. These run the gamut from spiritual to funny, from touching to shocking to scary. We got some sci-fi, we've got some poetry, there are some songs and some jokes. Robin Bullock supplied the instrumental music. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience.
Hi, this is Mark Anderson, and this is a poem entitled Christmas Hash by Ogden Nash. Tiny reindeer hoofs are drumming. Listen, Santa Claus is coming. See his stomach bulge and billow? That is Mother's favorite pillow. All her cotton, as she feared, has been purloined to make his beard. Her lipstick sets his cheeks a-glowing. His chest expands with a ho-ho-hoing. That last ho-ho was not too smart. Santa Claus has come apart.
Timothy Jewell, and I'm reading Santa Calls by William Joyce. Art Atchison Amesworth was a very singular boy. Orphaned at an early age by a gang of desperados, he had applied himself wholeheartedly to the making of inventions, the quest for adventure, and the fighting and smashing of crime. He lived in Abilene, Texas, with his aunt and uncle, who ran a Wild West show and animal phantasmagoria. He had a best friend, Spalding Little Feet, a young Comanche brave. He also had a little sister named Esther. If Art had one weakness, it was sweets and candy of any sorts. If he had one flaw, it was that he was often mean to his sister Esther. But that was all before the amazing Christmas of 1908, before the extraordinary adventure, before the mysterious box arrived and changed young Art forever. They found the box outside their prairie laboratory one dusty December day just before Christmas. No one knew how it had gotten there, and the only clue to its origins was a large SC stamped on one side. "Holy mackerel," said Art. "What a mystery." "I suggest we examine it scientifically," said Spalding. And so, using the most scientific method at their disposal, they poked the box with a stick. A note instantly emerged. It read, "Open the box, assemble the contents, come north, yours, SC. "SC," they all wondered aloud. "By the rings of Saturn," cried Art, examining the box with a magnifying glass of his own design, "I've got it." Spalding stepped closer and whispered, "You mean..." "Yes," said Art, "it's from Santa Claus himself." "Gee whiz," sighed Esther in awe, "Santa calls." Inside their prairie laboratory, Art and Spalding set about opening the box. They poked and pried and pushed and shoved, but nothing worked. "I wish it would open," said Esther. The box rattled, then shook, then quaked, then opened. They were thunderstruck. "It appears to be a flying machine," said Spalding. "To fly north in," said Art. "To see Santa," said Spalding. "But why?" wondered Art. Esther smiled but said nothing. For 3 days they worked feverishly. The basket they were to ride in was broken, so Spalding lent his beloved canoe to the cause, and by dawn on Christmas Eve, the Yuletide Flyer, as they christened the amazing machine, was ready to fly. At first, Art refused to let Esther make the trip. "You're too little to come," he told her as he prepared to leave. "I'll tell if you don't let me go," she threatened. Art gazed at her squarely and said, "You know, an Amesworth never tells." Esther watched solemnly as Spalding started the engine. A single tear trickled down her cheek. "Oh, all right, get in," Art relented. "You won't be sorry," she said, jumping aboard. "To the pole," shouted Art, and they lifted away undetected into the northern skies toward the icy unknown and Santa himself. By afternoon, using a compass of his own design, Art piloted them to the polar ice cap at the very top of the world. I wonder why Santa has called for us, said Spaulding as he reached for a blanket. To solve an Arctic crime wave, I'd imagine, said Art as he popped a candy into his mouth. They all grew quiet. There, just ahead, was the North Pole, shining through the clouds. It was the most beautiful thing they had ever seen. Their descent was graceful, but their landing was a catastrophe. The Yuletide flyer spun wildly out of control, crashing into the very base of the Great Pole. We appear to be up an Arctic creek without a paddle, said Spaulding as he examined the wreckage of his beloved canoe. We may be down, but we're not out, said Art, scanning the endless icy horizon with a spyglass of his own design. A man in a dogless sled sped toward them. I am Ali Aku, captain of the Santarian Guard, he announced, jumping from the sled. Step lively now. There's no time to waste. Darkness falls quickly here, and with it come the Dark Elves and their evil queen. What are Dark Elves? Asked Spaulding, climbing aboard. Trouble, said Ali Aku evenly, and he gunned the sled across the frozen tundra. Within minutes, twilight was upon them, and with it an attacking army of Dark Elves, led by their villainous queen. Charge! Shouted Ali Aku as they flew forward. Seize them! Screamed the Dark Queen. A barrage of snowballs filled the air. With ice spheres and slingshot, they scattered the elves like ninepins. And Esther, little Esther, scored a direct hit on the Dark Queen herself. Good shot, said Art. Top notch, absolutely bully, Esther smiled. It was the first nice thing Art had said to her for over a month. Straight ahead to Toyland, yelled Ali Aku, and at a flick of a switch, the dogless sled soared up into the sky. You've not seen the last of me, little girl, screeched the villainous Dark Queen. But Esther hardly heard her, for the glowing lights of Toyland were now in sight. Toyland was everything they wished for and more than they had ever dreamed possible. It was a vast, glorious, and glittering city. Creatures of every continent and people from every land brought together for one purpose and one purpose only, pronounced Ali Aku, to make toys. But why has Santa sent for us? Asked Art. I know not, replied Ali as he steered them to an open square in the heart of the metropolis. A huge sign read, The best of the old, the best of the new, the best that is yet to be. The Toyland motto, said Ali, saluting proudly as they landed. Now we go to bed, said Ali. You must always go to bed before you see Santa. It's the rule. Suddenly an extraordinary galloping bed pulled up. To Santa and step on it, commanded Ali Aku, and the bed sprinted them through the shimmering streets. They were escorted by a troop of splendidly uniformed dogs. The canine brigade, remarked Ali, Santa's personal pets. To receive one is the highest honor in Toyland. By the moons of Jupiter, this is a swell place, said Art, and he wished more than anything in the world to someday have a pup of the canine brigade. Then from the great hall of Santa, Mrs. Claus rushed out to welcome them. All of Toyland cheered. Why is everyone so happy to see us? Asked Spaulding as the bed came to a stop amidst the cheering crowds. Some secrets are better left unsolved, young man. Mrs. Claus smiled. We must bustle, she added as she hurried them on. Santa is waiting. Mrs. Claus led them into an enormous room. The crowd parted. Drums rolled. Ali Aku bowed. The room grew quiet. And there stood Santa. If ever there was a man about whom there was an unmistakable air of mirth and magic, it was this dashing, rotund fellow who stood before them now. He was every inch a Santa Claus. Spaulding, Art, and dear little Esther, he said gladly, you're just in time. He stepped down from the globe of good children and waved them closer. Shall we take a ride? Yes, cried Esther. The two boys could only nod, speechless. It's Christmas Eve. My sleigh is the order of the day, Santa snapped his fingers, and the Christmas sleigh was brought forth. Santa hoisted the children aboard. Why in the name of Neptune did you call for us? Asked Art when he regained his voice. Santa chuckled. He smiled at Esther and put his hand on Art's shoulder. Some secrets are best left unsolved, Mr. Amesworth. For now, just enjoy the ride. Santa cracked his whip, the sleigh took flight, and they shot out over Toyland. Trumpets blared, flags waved, thousands cheered, and above it all, Santa's voice rang loud and clear. Merry Christmas, one and all, Merry Christmas. As they flew over the pole, ominous clouds appeared. A balloon unlike the others swerved into their path. Out of the way, bellowed Santa, but the sky grew thick with dark elves, ice, and snowballs. A cluster of dark elves swept aboard and plucked Esther from the sleigh. Esther, shouted Art, reaching for her. The queen squealed with delight. To the castle, she cried, and they vanished into the clouds. Call out the guard and attack the queen's castle, commanded Santa. Esther must be saved. Wait, said Art urgently, for he felt something he had not felt before. She's my sister, and I will save her. Do the elves have a weakness? Candy, replied Santa. Art's eyebrows shot up. Aha, he said. I have a new invention, Ali, Spaulding. I need your help. And so, under cover of darkness, Art, Spaulding, and Ali Aku crept into the fearsome castle of the Dark Elves. They found Esther soon enough, held prisoner before a giant boiling cauldron. The whole army of Dark Elves stood chanting, Gimme, gimme, gimme. It's the only word in their language, whispered Ali Aku. Unhand my sister, you Arctic ruffians, Art shouted, rushing forward and hurling a candy bomb of his own design. There was a loud explosion. Smoke filled the room. Candy rained down as the dark elves scattered. Up the tower steps, Art and his stalwart band dashed, with the queen and her elves in hot pursuit. I've still got one trick up my sleeve, panted Art. What? Whispered Esther. Licorice. Art replied as he quickly passed out supplies of the wretched black candy. No villain in the world can resist it. They held their ground and waited. The dark horde surged closer. You can't escape me now, sneered the queen. Let 'em have it, shouted Art, and they let loose their bitter barrage. Licorice, squealed the queen helplessly. The dark elves clamored greedily for the candy. All was chaos. Then a great jovial laugh pierced the commotion. There, at the top of the stairs, they could just make out the silhouette of Santa, and behind him, the sleigh. Well, just in the saint nick of time, said Art as he grabbed Esther's hand and helped her away. Thanks for coming to get me, said Esther to her brother as they climbed aboard the sleigh. Art was quiet for a moment. Well, Christmas wouldn't be the same without you around, he said. He squeezed her hand. Besides, you're too good a shot to leave behind. Esther smiled. Santa laughed. Mr. Amesworth, he said, Merry Christmas to you. And he cracked his whip. What's our first stop, Mrs. Claus? Abilene, Texas, she replied, and the sleigh took off. In no time, they were back in Texas and landing outside their prairie laboratory. Suddenly, Art, Esther, and Spaulding were very sleepy. What's happening? Asked Esther. Nothing to worry about, said Mrs. Claus, as the children were carried quietly into the house. Just a little Christmas magic, added Ali Aku. As they were being tucked into bed, Santa asked, Did you enjoy the ride, Mr. Amesworth? Very much, said Art, fighting to stay awake. But why did you call for us? Santa didn't answer. Then, as Art drifted asleep, he heard Santa say softly, Good night, my fine, brave children. Merry Christmas dreams, and remember, some secrets are best left unsolved. The next morning they awoke with a start. Was it all just a dream? Wondered Spaulding. I hope not, said Esther. I'd bet the farm it wasn't, said Art, and rushed outside. By the prairie laboratory, in the very spot where they'd first found Santa's mysterious box, there sat a splendid new canoe for Spaulding, the Yuletide Flyer II painted on its side. For Art, there was a handsome little puppy of the Canine Brigade with a bag of exquisite candy tied around its neck. And for Esther, there was only an envelope. By the stars above, sang Art, picking up his pup and popping a candy in his mouth, it's all true. An amazing man, that Santa, said Spaulding as he examined his canoe. Esther opened her envelope. Inside were two letters. She looked them over eagerly, then tucked them into her robe. She was grinning from ear to ear. Is that all you got? Just some letters? Asked Spaulding. Oh, it's much more than that, replied Esther. What did they say, sis? Asked Art excitedly. Still grinning, she looked Art squarely in the eye and said, You know an Ainsworth never tells. Art thought a moment and then laughed out loud. Right you are, he said. Come on, let's play with the pup. And play they did, happily, joyfully, till sunset and beyond, as they rushed under the evening sky, eating Art's candy, Spaulding wondered aloud, we still don't know why Santa called for us. Yep, said Art, but we did have a swell time, didn't we, Esther? Esther nodded. I guess it's like Santa said, some secrets are best left unsolved, Art offered. Maybe, Spaulding agreed. Esther just smiled and they all laughed. Supper's ready, called Auntie Ainsworth from the kitchen porch. They ran inside to the warmth of their house, and they were happy, each one of them. They'd smashed a crime with a new invention, they'd had a great adventure, and Art and Esther were now at last friends. And on that Christmas day, all was right with their world. And the two letters read. One from Esther said, Dear Santa, you can send me toys if you like, but what I really wish for is for my brother Art to be my friend. Yours, Esther Ainsworth. And the second letter was from Santa, and it said, Dear Esther, such a rare and wonderful request could not be refused. I'm glad our little adventure did the trick. Santa.
This is Fred Corlett, reading Compliments of the Season by O. Henry. There are no more Christmas stories to write. Fiction is exhausted, and newspaper items, the next best, are manufactured by clever young journalists who have married early and have an engagingly pessimistic view of life. Therefore, for seasonable diversion, we are reduced to very questionable sources, facts, and philosophy. We will begin with whichever you choose to call it. Now come the facts in the case of the rag doll, the tatterdemalion, and the 25th of December. On the 10th of that month, the child of the millionaire lost her rag doll. There were many servants in the millionaire's palace on the Hudson, and these ransacked the house and grounds, but without finding the lost treasure. The child was a girl of 5, and one of those perverse little beasts that often wound the sensibility of wealthy parents by fixing their affections upon some vulgar, inexpensive toy instead of upon diamond-studded automobiles and ponies. The child grieved sorely and truly, a thing inexplicable to the millionaire, to whom the rag doll market was about as interesting as Bay State gas, and to the lady, the child's mother, who was all form. That is, nearly all, as you shall see. The child cried inconsolably and grew hollow-eyed, knock-kneed and spindling. The millionaire smiled and tapped his coffers confidently. The pick of the output of the French and German toy makers was rushed by special delivery to the mansion. But Rachel refused to be comforted. She was weeping for her rag child and was for a high protective tariff against all foreign foolishness. Then doctors with the finest bedside manners and stopwatches were called in. One by one they chattered futilely about sea voyages and hypophosphites until their stopwatches showed that Bill Rendered was under the wire for show or place. Then, as men, they advised that the rag doll be found as soon as possible and restored to its mourning parent. The child sniffed at therapeutics, chewed a thumb, and wailed for her Betsy. And all this time, cablegrams were coming from Santa Claus saying that he would soon be here and enjoining us to show a true Christian spirit and give him a welcome. Everywhere the spirit of Christmas was diffusing itself, The banks were refusing loans. The pawnbrokers had doubled their gang of helpers. People bumped your shins on the streets with red sleds. Holly wreaths of hospitality were hung in windows of the stores, and they who had 'em were getting their furs. You hardly knew which was the best bed in Balls, high, moth, or snow. It was no time at which to lose the rag doll or your heart. If Dr. Watson's investigating friend had been called in to solve this mysterious disappearance, he might have observed on the millionaire's wall a copy of The Vampire. That would have quickly suggested, by induction, a rag and a bone and a hank of hair. Flip, a Scotch terrier, next to the rag doll in the child's heart, frisked through the halls. The hank of hair. Aha! X, the unfound quantity, represented the rag doll. But the bone. Well, when dogs find bones, they... Done! It were an easy and fruitful task to examine Flip's forefeet. Look, Watson. Earth. Dried earth between the toes. Of course, the dog, but Sherlock was not there, therefore it devolves. The millionaire's palace occupied a lordly space. In front of it was a lawn, close mowed as a South Ireland man's face, 2 days after a shave. At one side of it, and fronting on another street, was a garage and stables. The Scotch pup had ravaged the rag doll from the nursery, dragged it to a corner of the lawn, dug a hole, and buried it after the manner of careless undertakers. There you have the mystery solved. Then let's get down to the heart of the thing. Tiresome readers, the Christmas heart of the thing. Fuzzy was drunk. Not riotously, or helplessly, or loquaciously, as you or I might get, but decently, appropriately, and inoffensively, as becomes a gentleman down on his luck. Fuzzy was a soldier of misfortune. The road, the haystack, the park bench, the kitchen door, the petty pickings and ignobly garnered largesse of great cities, these formed the chapters of his history. Fuzzy walked toward the river, down the street that bounded one side of the millionaire's house and grounds. He saw a leg of Betsy, the lost rag doll, protruding, like the clue to a Lilliputian murder mystery, from its untimely grave in a corner of the fence. He dragged forth the maltreated infant, tucked it under his arm, and went on his way crooning a road song of his brethren that no doll that has been brought up to the sheltered life should hear. Well, for Betsy, that she had no ears, and well, that she had no eyes, save unseeing circles of black, for the faces of Fuzzy and the Scotch terrier were those of brothers, and the heart of no rag doll could withstand twice to become the prey of such fearsome monsters. Though you may not know it, Grogan's Saloon stands near the river and near the foot of the street down which Fuzzy traveled. In Grogan's, Christmas cheer was already rampant. Fuzzy entered with his doll. He fancied that as a mummer at the feast of Saturn, he might earn a few drops from the wassail cup. He set Betsy on the bar and addressed her loudly and humorously, seasoning his speeches with exaggerated compliments and endearments, as one entertaining his lady friend. The loafers and bibbers around caught the farce of it and roared. The bartender gave Fuzzy a drink. Oh, many of us carry rag dolls. One for the lady, suggested Fuzzy impudently, and tucked another contribution to art beneath his waistcoat. He began to see possibilities in Betsy. His first night had been a success. Visions of a vaudeville circuit about town dawned upon him. In a group near the stove sat Pigeon McCarthy, Black Riley, and One Ear Mike, well and unfavorably known through the tough shoestring district that blackened the left bank of the river. They passed a newspaper back and forth among themselves. The item that each solid and blunt forefinger pointed out was an advertisement headed $100 Reward. To earn it, one must return the rag doll lost, strayed, or stolen from the millionaire's mansion. It seemed that grief still ravaged unchecked in the bosom of the too faithful child. Flip the terrier capered and shook his absurd whisker before her, powerless to distract. She wailed for her Betsy in the faces of walking, talking, mama-ing, and eye-closing French Maybells and violets. The advertisement was a last resort. Black Riley came from behind the stove and approached Fuzzy in his one-sided parabolic way. The Christmas mummer, flushed with success, had tucked Betsy under his arm and was about to depart to the filling of impromptu dates elsewhere. "Say, Bo," said Black Riley to him, "where'd you cop out that doll?" "This doll?" asked Fuzzy, touching Betsy with his forefinger to be sure that she was the one referred to. "This doll was presented to me by the Emperor of Baluchistan. I have 700 others in my country home in Newport. This doll..." "Cheese the funny business," said Riley. "You swiped it or picked it up at the house on the hill where... But never mind that. You want to take 50 cents for the rags? Me brother's kid at home might be wanting to play with it. Hey, what?" He produced the coin. Fuzzy laughed a gurgling, insolent, alcoholic laugh in his face. "Go to the office of Sarah Bernhardt's manager and propose to him that she be released from a night's performance to entertain the Tackytown Lyceum and Literary Coterie, and you will hear the duplicate of Fuzzy's laugh." Black Riley gauged Fuzzy quickly with his blueberry eye, as a wrestler does. His hand was itching to play the Roman and wrest the rag Sabine from the extemporaneous Mary Andrew, who was entertaining an angel unaware. But he refrained. Fuzzy was fat and solid and big. Countless small circular wrinkles running around his coat sleeves and knees guaranteed the quality of his bone and muscle. His small blue eyes, bathed in the moisture of altruism and wooziness, looked upon you kindly, yet without abashment. He was whiskerly, fleshily, formidable. So Black Riley temporized. "What'll you take for it, then?" he asked. "Money," said Fuzzy with husky firmness, "cannot buy her." He was intoxicated with the artist's first sweet cup of attainment. To set a faded blue earth-stained rag doll on a bar, to hold mimic converse with it, and to find his heart leaping with the sense of plaudits earned, and his throat scorching with free libations poured in his honor, could base coin buy him from such achievements? You will perceive that Fuzzy had the temperament. Fuzzy walked out with the gait of a trained sea lion in search of other cafes to conquer. Though the dusk of twilight was hardly yet apparent, lights were beginning to spangle the city like popcorn bursting in a deep skillet. Christmas Eve, impatiently expected, was peeping over the brink of the hour. Millions had prepared for its celebration. Towns would be painted red. You, yourself, have heard the horns and dodged the capers of the Saturnalians. Pigeon McCarthy, Black Riley, and One Ear Mike held a hasty converse outside Grogan's. They were narrow-chested, pallid striplings, not fighters in the open, but more dangerous in their ways of warfare than the most terrible of Turks. Fuzzy, in a pitched battle, could have beaten the three of them. In a go-as-you-please encounter, he was already doomed. They overtook him just as he and Betsy were entering Costigan's casino. They deflected him and shoved the newspaper under his nose. Fuzzy could read, and more. "Boys," he said, "you were certainly damn true friends. Give me a week to think it over." The soul of a real artist is quenched with difficulty. The boys carefully pointed out to him that advertisements were soulless, and that the deficiencies of the day might not be supplied by the morrow. "A cool 100, said Fuzzy thoughtfully and mushily. "Boys," he said, "you are true friends. I'll go up and claim the reward. The show business is not what it used to be." Night was falling more surely. The three tagged at his sides to the foot on the rise on which stood the millionaire's house. There Fuzzy turned upon them acrimoniously. "You are a pack of putty-faced beagle hounds," he roared. "Go away." They went away. A little away. In Pigeon McCarthy's pocket was a section of 1-inch gas pipe 8 inches long. In one end of it, and in the middle of it, was a lead plug. One half of it was packed tight with solder. Black Riley carried a slung shot, being a conventional thug. One Ear Mike relied upon a pair of brass knuckles, an heirloom in the family. "Why fetch and carry," said Black Riley, "when someone will do it for you?" Let him bring it out to us. Hey, what? We can chuck him in the river, said Pigeon McCarthy, with a stone tied to his feet. Fuzzy entered the billionaire's gate and zigzagged toward the softly glowing entrance of the mansion. The three goblins came up to the gate and lingered, one on each side of it, one beyond the roadway. They fingered their cold metal and leather, confident. Fuzzy rang the doorbell, smiled foolishly and dreamily. An atavistic instinct prompted him to reach for the button of his right glove, but he wore no gloves. So his left hand dropped, embarrassed. The particular menial whose duty it was to open doors to silks and laces shied at first sight of Fuzzy, but a second glance took in his passport, his card of admission, his surety of welcome, the lost rag doll of the daughter of the house dangling under his arm. Fuzzy was admitted into a great hall, dim with the glow from unseen lights. The hireling went away and returned with a maid and the child. The doll was restored to the mourning one. She clasped her lost darling to her breast, and then, with the inordinate selfishness and candor of childhood, stamped her foot and whined hatred and fear of the odious being who had rescued her from the depths of sorrow and despair. Fuzzy wriggled himself into an ingratiatory attitude and essayed the idiotic smile and blathering small talk that is supposed to charm the budding intellect of the young. The child bawled and was dragged away, hugging her Betsy close. There came the secretary, pale, poised, polished, gliding in pumps and worshipping pomp and ceremony. He counted out into Fuzzy's hand 10 $10 bills, then dropped his eye upon the door, transferred it to James, its custodian, indicated the obnoxious earner of the reward with the other, and allowed his pumps to waft him away to secretarial regions. James gathered Fuzzy with his own commanding optic, and swept him as far as the front door. When the money touched Fuzzy's dingy palm, his first instinct was to take to his heels, but a second thought restrained him from that blunder of etiquette. It was his. It had been given to him. He had tumbled to the foot of the ladder. He was hungry, homeless, friendless, ragged, cold, drifting, and he held in his hand the key to a paradise of the mud-honey that he craved. The fairy doll had waved a wand with her rag-stuffed hand, and now, wherever he might go, the enchanted palaces with shining footrests and magic red fluids in gleaming glassware would be open to him. He followed James to the door. He paused there as the flunky drew open the great mahogany portal for him to pass into the vestibule. Beyond the wrought-iron gates in the dark highway, Black Riley and his two pals casually strolled, fingering under their coats the inevitably fatal weapons that were to make the reward of the rag doll theirs. Fuzzy stopped at the millionaire's door and bethought himself. Like little sprigs of mistletoe on a dead tree, certain living green thoughts and memories began to decorate his confused mind. He was quite drunk, mind you, and the present was beginning to fade. Those wreaths and festoons of holly, with their scarlet berries making the great hall gay, where had he seen such things before? Somewhere he had known polished floors and odors of fresh flowers in winter, and someone was singing a song in the house that he thought he had heard before. Someone singing and playing a harp. Of course, it was Christmas. Fuzzy thought he must be pretty drunk to have overlooked that. And then he went out of the present, and there came back to him, out of some impossible, vanished and irrevocable past, a little, pure white, transient, forgotten ghost. The spirit of noblesse oblige. Upon a gentleman, certain things devolve. James opened the outer door. A stream of light went down the graveled walk to the iron gate. Black Riley, McCarthy, and One Ear Mike saw and carelessly drew their sinister cordon closer about the gate. With a more imperious gesture than James's master had ever used or could ever use, Fuzzy compelled the menial to close the door. Upon a gentleman, certain things devolve, especially at the Christmas season. It is customary, he said to James, the flustered, "when a gentleman calls on Christmas Eve to pass the compliments of the season with the lady of the house. You understand? I shall not move a step till I pass compliment season with lady of the house. Understand?" There was an argument. James lost. Fuzzy raised his voice and sent it through the house unpleasantly. I did not say he was a gentleman. He was simply a tramp, being visited by a ghost. A sterling silver bell rang. James went back to answer it, leaving Fuzzy in the hall. James explained somewhere to someone. Then he came and conducted Fuzzy into the library. The lady entered a moment later. She was more beautiful and holy than any picture that Fuzzy had seen. She smiled and said something about a doll. Fuzzy didn't understand that. He remembered nothing about a doll. A footman brought in two small glasses of sparkling wine on a stamped sterling silver waiter. The lady took one. The other was handed to Fuzzy. As his fingers closed on the slender glass stem, his disabilities dropped from him for one brief moment. He straightened himself, and time, so disobliging to most of us, turned backward to accommodate Fuzzy. Forgotten Christmas ghosts, whiter than the false beards of the most opulent Kris Kringle, were rising in the fumes of Grogan's whiskey. What had the millionaire's mansion to do with a long, wainscoted Virginia hall, where the riders were grouped around a silver punch bowl drinking the ancient toast of the house? And what had Fuzzy to do with any of it? The lady, looking at him over her glass, let her condescending smile fade away like a false dawn. Her eyes turned serious. She saw something beneath the rags and Scotch terrier whiskers that she did not understand, but it did not matter. Fuzzy lifted his glass and smiled vacantly.
Pardon, lady, he said, but couldn't leave without exchanging compliments season with lady the house. Against principles, gentlemen do show.
And then he began the ancient salutation that was a tradition in the house when men wore lace ruffles and powder. The blessings of another year. Fuzzy's memory failed him. The lady prompted, be upon this hearth.
The guest, stammered Fuzzy.
And upon her who, continued the lady with a leading smile.
Oh, cut it out, said Fuzzy ill-manneredly. I can't remember. Drink hearty.
Fuzzy had shot his arrow. They drank. The lady smiled again, the smile of her caste. James enveloped and reconducted him toward the front door. The harp music still softly drifted through the house. Outside, Black Riley breathed on his cold hands and hugged the gate. I wonder, said the lady to herself, musing, who... But there were so many who came. I wonder whether memory is a curse or a blessing to them after they have fallen so low. Fuzzy and his escort were nearly at the door. The lady called, James! James stalked back obsequiously, leaving Fuzzy waiting unsteadily, with his brief spark of the divine fire gone. Outside, Black Riley stamped his cold feet and got a firmer grip on his section of gas pipe.
You will conduct this gentleman, said the lady, downstairs. Then tell Lewis to get out the Mercedes and take him to whatever place he wishes to go.
History of a Christmas Pie by Nancy Willard, read by Megan Mercer Bourne. Devil in a dumpling, 10 hands high, how shall I make my Christmas pie? Here I come, Sir Cinnamon, under my hat 1,000 men, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Miss Mace to clear the way. Here I come, good Mistress Mace, turning lemons into lace, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Nutmeg to clear the way. Here I come, clever Nutmeg, I beat the devil at Mumbly Peg, and if you don't believe what I say, here's Father Salt to clear the way. Here I come, old Father Salt, with a jumble of joys and a funnel of faults, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Clove to clear the way. Here I come, good Master Clove, my true love lies beyond your stove, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Ginger to clear the way. Here I come, the Ginger Man, I comb my hair with a pudding pan, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Pepper to clear the way. Here I come, saucy Pepper, I caught a dragon for my supper, and if you don't believe what I say, here's Lord Annis to clear the way. Here I come, Annis the Great, I burned the pie and ate the plate. Angel in an eggshell, cricket in a coop, how shall I make my Christmas soup? Here I come, oregano, I taught a raven how to row, and if you don't believe what I say, here's Master Sage to clear the way. Here I come, wise Master Sage, I locked my shadow in a cage, and if you don't believe what I say, here's Captain Time to clear the way. Here I come, brave Captain Time, I make my men work overtime, and if you don't believe what I say, here comes Coriander to clear the way. Here I come, old Coriander, friend of the Emperor Alexander, and if you don't believe what I say, here's Old Man Dill to clear the way. Here I come, Old Man Dill, I eat my lunch on the window sill, and if you don't believe what I say, here come the children to clear the way. Here we come, Miss Rosemary and Marjoram and Caraway, and here comes Papa Tarragon, and now the Christmas soup is done. Pie in the oven, and soup on the fire, a bowl for the peddler, a bell for the crier. Herbs in the pantry, spices on the shelf. If you want any more, you must cook it yourself.
The Night Train to Chicago, written and read by Laura Town. The train car clinks and clunks through the night. Cladunk, cladunk, cladunk. The gentle sway shifts her silk skirt against his wool trousers, pushes her into his solid warmth, and then away again. The violet netting on the woman's hat in front of her trembles with the motion of the train. Mary Ellen looks out the window, peers past her reflection to the snow-covered world outside. Christmas lights of red and green and gold slide by as they chug from her hometown of Gary, Indiana. They're en route to Chicago, where he will catch another train, headed for New York, and then a ship overseas. Their tearful goodbye at Union Station will be her last memory of him. They sublet their little apartment, and she would stay with her aunt in Chicago a few days before traveling back to Gary, to her mother's house. She would get a job as a stenographer in an insurance office, something safe and routine, something to keep her mind and hands busy. But her heart will be in a plane, flying missions over French fields. She looks down at her hands. Her wedding ring feels strange, its newness not yet a part of her. Her moleskin gloves, a Christmas gift from her mother, stretch taut and elegant around her long fingers. Disentangling one from the warm hand it holds, she pulls the material loose until the first finger flops downward, then the second, and the third, and finally the pinky until her hand is free. Pale and cold, she slips it back into the sacred home it longs for. His hand clutches briefly at the contact, skin to skin, as though first-time lovers. Memories of thighs and stomachs, of hips and shoulders sliding and glistening in the steam heat of a small apartment radiator come to life in the grasp of those fingers. She shivers against him, against the night, the cold, against the war across the sea. They say little, having already said everything possible and impossible. Their hands express more than words. The army is a cruel taskmaster, tearing him away just after Christmas and in the middle of the night. Trains can leave in the morning. Ships can hold in their moorings. Nazis can wait to be shot down. The world can stop for a few more hours. At least she thinks so. He would leave soon enough, and she would be stronger in the morning hours, the bitter gray dawn easier to bear alone than the shelter of night. "It will be okay," his voice is low in her ear. "They say they're pushing back hard, losing the Russian front. It won't be long now." The statement is strong and forceful, self-convincing, just a tinge of youthful uncertainty. They were babies, her mother had said. He was barely 22, she was 20. Too young to get married, too young to fight, to fly planes, too young to answer the door of her mother's house, finding somber-faced soldiers on the stoop, a government letter in their hands. Her mother was right. Someone slides a window open, and her gloved hand covers their bare ones, sheltering them from the sudden chill. The window closes again to a sigh of relief from the passengers. She looks down to see a teardrop darkening the softness of the single gray glove. She didn't mean to cry. She wanted to be strong. Then another falls to join it, not from her eyes, but his. The two drops seep together into one tiny stain. She will wrap the new moleskin gloves in tissue when she gets back home, where they will stay throughout the winter and into spring when the black-bordered telegram arrives. Taking them out to feel the soft material, she'll touch them briefly to her lips, the smell of his hand still there, barely there. They will lay side by side on top of the folded flag in her bureau, the joined teardrop, a salty, faint memory of the night train to Chicago.
Matthew Wood reading The Christmas Truce by Aaron Shepherd. Christmas Day, 1914. My dear Sister Janet, it is 2 a.m. and most of our men are sleeping in their foxholes, yet I could not sleep before writing to you of the most wonderful events this Christmas Eve. What happened seems almost like a fairy tale, and if I hadn't been through it myself, I wouldn't believe it. Just imagine. While you and the family sang carols before the fire, I did the same thing with enemy soldiers here on the battlefields of France. As I wrote before, there has been little serious fighting of late. The first battles of the war left so many dead that both sides have held back until replacements could come from home. So we've mostly stayed in our trenches and waited. But what a terrible waiting. Knowing that any moment an artillery shell might land and explode beside us. And in the daylight not daring to lift our heads above the ground for fear of a sniper's bullet. And the rain collects right in our trenches and we bail it out with our pots and pans and the mud. A good foot of mud or more deep, it splatters and cakes everything. Through all this, we couldn't help feeling curious about the German soldiers across the way. After all, they faced the same dangers we did and slogged about in the same muck. What's more, their trench was only about 50 yards from ours. Between us lay no man's land, bordered on both sides by barbed wire, yet they were close enough we sometimes heard their voices. Of course, we hated them, but other times we joked about them and almost felt that we had something in common. And now, it seems, they felt the same. Just yesterday morning, Christmas Eve day, we got our first good freeze. Cold as we were, we welcomed it, because at least it froze the mud solid. Everything was tinged white with frost, while the bright sun shone over all. It was perfect Christmas weather. During the day, there was little shelling or rifle fire from either side, and as darkness fell on our Christmas Eve, the shooting stopped entirely. Our first complete silence in months. We hoped it might be a promise of a peaceful holiday, but we didn't count on it. We'd been told the Germans might attack and try to catch us off guard. I went out to the dugout to rest, and lying on my cot, I must have drifted asleep. All at once, my friend John was shaking me awake, saying, "Come on, see. See what the Germans are doing." I grabbed my rifle, stumbled out of the trench, and stuck my head out cautiously above the sandbags. I never hoped to see a stranger and more lovely sight. Clusters of tiny lights were shining all along the German line, left and right as far as the eye could see. "What is it?" I asked in bewilderment, and John answered, "Christmas trees." And so it was. The Germans had placed Christmas trees in front of their trenches, lit by candle or lanterns, like beacons of goodwill. And then we heard their voices raised in song. When the song finished, the men in our trenches applauded. Yes, British soldiers applauded Germans. Then one of our own men started singing, and we all joined in. "The first Noel the angels did sing." In truth, we sounded not nearly as good as the Germans with their fine harmonies, but they responded with an enthusiastic applauding and their own and began to sing, "O Tannenbaum, O Tannenbaum." And then we replied, "O come, all ye faithful." But by this time they joined in singing the same Latin words, "Edeste fidelis." British and Germans harmonizing across no man's land. I would have thought nothing ever the like of this could have happened. "English, come over," we heard one of them shout. "You no shoot, we no shoot." There in the trenches, we looked at each other in bewilderment, and then one of us shouted jokingly, "You come over here." To our astonishment, we saw two figures rise from the trench, climbing over their barbed wire and advancing across the unprotected no man's land. One of them called, "Send officer to talk." I saw one of our men lift his rifle to the ready, and no doubt others did the same, but our captain called out, "Hold your fire." Then he climbed out and went to meet the Germans halfway. We heard them talking, and a few minutes later the captain came back with a German cigar in his mouth. "We've agreed there'll be no shooting before midnight tomorrow," he announced, "but sentries are to remain on duty, and the rest of you stay alert." Across the way, we could make out groups of two or three other men starting out of their trenches and coming towards us. Then some of us were climbing out too, and in only a few minutes over 100 soldiers and officers from each side were in the middle of no man's land shaking hands. Before long, a bonfire was built, and around it we mingled, British khaki and German gray. I must say the Germans were the better dressed, with fresh uniforms for the holiday. Only a couple of our men knew German, but more the Germans knew English. I asked one of them why that was. "Because many of us have worked in England. Before this, I was a waiter at the Hotel Cecil. Perhaps I waited on your table." "Perhaps you did," I said, laughing. He told me he had a girlfriend in London and that he had intended on asking her to marry him, but the war interrupted their plans. Another German had been a porter at the Victoria Station, and he showed me a picture of his family back in Munich. His eldest sister was quite lovely. I said I should like to meet her some day, and he beamed and said he would like that very much, and gave me his family's address. Even those who could not converse could still exchange gifts, our cigarettes for their cigars, our tea for their coffee, our corned beef for their sausage, badges and buttons from uniforms, changed owners. I myself traded a jackknife for a leather equipment belt, a fine souvenir to show when I get home. Newspapers, too, changed hands, and the Germans howled and laughed at ours. They assured us that France was finished and that Russia was nearly beaten, too. We told them that it was nonsense, and one of them said to us, "Well, you believe your newspapers, and we'll believe ours." Clearly they are lied to, yet after meeting these men, I wonder how truthful our newspapers had been. These are not the savage barbarians we've read so much about. They are men with homes and families, hopes and fears and principles, and yet a love of country. In other words, men like ourselves. Why are we led to believe otherwise? As it grew late, a few more songs were traded around the fire. Then we parted with promises to meet again tomorrow and even some talk of football. I was just starting back to the trenches when an older German clutched my arm and said, "Why cannot we have peace and all go home?" I told him gently, "That you must ask your emperor." He looked at me and said, "Perhaps, my friend, but we must also ask our hearts. And so, dear sister, tell me, has there ever been such a Christmas Eve in all history? And what does it all mean, this impossible befriending of enemies? For the fighting here regrettably means little. Decent fellows those soldiers may be, but they follow orders and we do the same. Besides, we are here to stop their army and to send it home, and we could never shirk that duty. Still, one cannot help imagine what would happen if the spirit shown here were caught by the nations of the world. Of course, disputes must always arise, but what if our leaders were to offer well wishes in the place of warnings, songs in the place of slurs, presents in the place of reprisals? Would not all war end at once? All nations say they want peace, yet on this Christmas morning, I wonder if we want it quite enough. Peace to you this blessed holiday, your loving brother Tom.